From 90.5 WESA, this is The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Lead, it's in our soil, it's in our old paint, and it's in our water. Lead levels in Pittsburgh's water exceeded federal action limits last June.
Well, the biggest thing that people worry about is uncertainty. And so they want to be able to have some certainty about whether or not the water that they're drinking is dangerous.
On today's program, a group of public media reporters discuss everything from the degrading pipe system that carries the water to snafus in the home testing process to replacing the lead pipes. Also, artists from Pittsburgh and around the country were in Washington this week to talk about the impact of federal support on the arts.
There would have been 20 projects in Pittsburgh that may not have happened, you know, this last year. It would hurt state arts funding and our capacity to do interesting work.
We'll discuss all that on The Confluence after this news update. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. Coming up, President Trump's budget will eliminate the National Endowment for the Arts. A look at how that could impact the arts in the Pittsburgh region. But first, after the lead and water crisis in Flint, Michigan, which was discovered in 2015, questions arose. What about our water? What is the extent of the overall lead issue? So WESA pulled together our public media partners, Allegheny Front, Public Source, and Keystone Crossroads, to dig into the legacy of lead in Pittsburgh from a variety of angles and to explore the impact on the environment, infrastructure, and, of course, on people. This week, during Morning Edition and All Things Considered, we've been presenting those reports. Next week, what can be done? Joining us now in studio, Liz Reed, health and science reporter for WESA. Welcome, Liz.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
And Reed Frazier, reporter for the Allegheny Front. Welcome back, Reed.
Thank you.
Tweet your questions, comments, and use the hashtag WESA Confluence. First, folks, some background. Lead pipes, lead lines, how extensive are they in the PWSA system?
Well, I'll take this one first. So the lines that take water down the streets to our, you know, into the neighborhoods are not lead. It is the service lines that take the water from the street pipe to your house, basically. About a quarter of those are lead. That's my understanding from my reporting on my story this week. So we'll get into this probably later in the hour, but one problem is that service line that takes it from the street to your house, part of that is owned by PWSA, but part of it is owned by the homeowner. So I have a house, you might have a house. Part of that responsibility for replacing the lead pipes rests with the homeowner, and that's right. Where things can get a little sticky.
Okay, and we are going to get more into that, who pays for it, who has to pay for it, even how expensive this can be. So, Liz, what are the rest of the service lines, what are the rest of the pipes made out of if they're not lead?
Well, as far as we know, they're made of copper, and they're made of this newer material called PEX, which is a I don't know the technical term, but it's a synthetic material. That they're hoping it's basically plastic, and they're hoping it's going to last at least 100 years, but it's fairly new, so they're not sure.
They're not sure about that, and not to be negative, is there any concern about any problems with this as far as health?
Well, that's the march of science. You know, we learn more about dangers in our environment as time marches on, so there's really no way to tell, but the best science we have right now shows us that this material is safe.
Okay, so to both of you, from your reporting for this series and other stories about the water in the Pittsburgh area, did concern over lead in the water in Pittsburgh only arise after Flint? Were water officials looking into it, concerned, whatever adjective you want to put on it, but only the public concern rose up, do you think? Yeah, Reed?
Yeah, so lead levels in the Pittsburgh area had actually been rising for about 10 years or so prior to today in the PWSA's water that they tested. Now, the water leaving the water plant is lead-free.
Right.
So any lead that gets into people's water in their houses comes up somewhere along the way.
From the plant to your spigot.
And the way they test this is they take a limited number of tests from people's houses, basically spigots. and they sample them, and if a certain percentage of them test over a threshold.
The top 10%.
The top 10%. So if the 10 worst samples have too much lead in them, then you're considered out of compliance. So they kept creeping up since 2007 or so. And the last sort of test that they were mandated to take in 2013, it was almost at 15, which is the threshold. It was at 14.8. So that's... you know, I think there's a question about what could have been done differently after that test was taken. They weren't mandated to do anything extra if they were just under the limit.
Okay. Now, was there any indication of why the levels had been rising in terms of the last few years? Was it just pipes are getting old?
That's certainly part of the calculus. I mean, these are, you know, 7,500-year-old pipes. And there is some question. I talked to the former head of water quality at PWSA, Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority, who suggested that perhaps because the PWSA has had to, like every water provider in the country has had to comply with new EPA rules on chlorination byproducts, they've had to change the way they chlorinate the water or just kind of vary up their processes. And he thinks maybe that has something to do with rising lead levels. The bottom line is we don't really know why they were creeping up, but we know that they were.
All right. We're going to get into a little chemistry 101 just a little bit in a moment or so. But, Reid, you spoke with Leonard Kasson, is it?
Yes.
A professor of civil engineering at Pitt. And Flint's problems arose as they were switching from the Detroit water system and temporarily were taking water from the Flint River. Let's hear what Leonard Kasson had to say to Reid.
They made that choice, and that choice is what led to or resulted in the lead issues that Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority is dealing with now.
What choice did they make?
Right. So what Leonard Kasson is talking about, and I should just say that Leonard Kasson used to has some ties to PWSA. He has done some scientific studies on their water quality in the past. He's also on a technical advisory board on water quality right now for them. But the key decision that everyone is staring at right now is this decision made in 2014 by the Water and Sewer Authority to switch from one anti-corrosive agent to another. From
soda ash?
Soda ash to caustic soda.
Okay, what's the difference and why the change?
Okay, well, the difference is...
Here's chemistry 101.
The bottom line difference is soda ash is better at leaving a coating on the inside of these lead pipes, and that's very key. It, you know, I'm probably not the one to kind of go into the real depths of the chemistry, but basically, once you mix soda ash into the water, it can release this kind of shell-like material on the inside of the pipe, and that will sort of insulate us when we're drinking the water from the lead that's in the pipe.
Okay.
Caustic soda, the other one, doesn't really do that so well. So it doesn't leave this kind of coating on the inside of the pipe. So the thinking is soda ash is just better for keeping lead out of our drinking water. Now the key difference.
So why switch?
Good question. So the obvious answer to that is that caustic soda costed more at the time that they made the switch.
Do you mean soda ash costed more?
I'm sorry.
The switch from soda ash to caustic soda.
The one that was less, shocker, the better chemical to use cost more than the one that wasn't as good. There were some sort of mitigating circumstances. There was a soda ash feeder that the equipment was bad and PWSA didn't really work out for them to use soda ash with that equipment. So maybe it wasn't that simple, but that's kind of how it is perceived out there to a lot of people, that this was a monetary decision.
And can I add something too? You know, looking at, I'm looking back at PWSA's numbers that they published for those compliance testings, with which before they were above the EPA action limit, they did every 3 years. So back in 2001, it was 6 parts per billion. That's pretty good. 2007, it was 9. 2010, it was 10. 2013, it was 14.8. So that 2000
just under the 15.
But the point is, you're saying in 2014 is when the chemical was changed. So this upward trajectory in that number happened before. So we've heard a lot of reporters and a lot of people say there's no one smoking gun. It's likely a combination of a lot of factors that led to this.
Okay. So the 14.8, but then it exceeded 15 when? Was it last June?
The compliance testing was done in June, and the letters to customers went out in July.
And what did those letters say, Liz? What did they say? Hey, here we found this reading. Do you want to have your water tested? What was the gist of it?
Yeah, so those letters did offer to people that PWSA would test their water if they wanted it.
Okay. So Pittsburghers wanted to know, is it safe? Is my water safe? And they asked for the test kits.
I could tell from talk that they were overwhelmed. They had taken on, they bit off more than they could chew with this process.
It was stressful, and the way we were doing it just wasn't efficient to handle this volume of requests.
That was first Dana Leahy of Morningside, followed by Gina Cyprich of PWSA. You spoke to both of them, Liz. So why was it stressful? I mean, we're talking about sheer numbers of requests or what?
Yeah, so how PWSA used to do it back when they were getting about 25 requests a year is they would actually send an employee out to drop the kit at your house just when that employee was driving around town for something else related to work. They would swing by, you do the test, and then let them know the kit was ready and leave it on the porch, and then they would pick it up. And you can see how this might be an okay system when you have 2 or 3 requests a month. Though I did hear from one person who emailed me and said that they had a hard time getting their results even before this flood of requests came in last summer. But here's the question I posed to PWSA, and I never really got a full answer. They sent out letters to about 82,000 individual customers saying the compliance testing had shown elevated lead levels and telling them that they could get their water tested. Then the following month in August, according to Gina Cyprich, who's the acting chief of water quality, they got back 3,000 requests for lead testing. So that comes out to about 3.6% of people who got the letters acted on it. So what PWSA basically said to me is that they didn't anticipate that 3.6% of people would act on their offer for a lead test. So it begs the question whether they really thought critically about what their needs might be following that announcement that the lead levels were above the EPA action level. And you know, like I said, so far I haven't gotten much of a response for them on that other than that they weren't prepared for the level of requests they got, which is why they didn't outsource the process sooner.
We're talking about lead in the water, part of the Hidden Poison series that has been produced by WESA and our public media partners, Allegheny Front, Public Source, and Keystone Crossroads. So during this time, where does Veolia come into play? Veolia was the private firm hired to manage, no longer managing the PWSA system. Reed, where does Veolia come into play? And of course, there's an ongoing legal action between the city and Veolia right now.
Yeah, this whole thing is kind of a mess. You know, let's go back to that decision to change the chemicals that a lot of people are pointing to as, you know, putting Pittsburgh over the edge in terms of lead compliance. At the time, Veolia, which is a private, you know, huge engineering firm, they had been hired by the PWSA under a previous mayoral administration, the current administration likes to point out, to manage PWSA. It's pretty complicated, but they had basically a deal that all the they would take home about half of the savings that they realized as managers. So if they cut the, you know, if they saved 100 grand, they would take home 50 grand. So they made this decision to switch the chemicals in 2014. About a year later, the Peduto administration fires Veolia. Now there's a lawsuit from PwSA against Veolia. They're trying to claw back some of the money that they paid them. So, like I said, it's a big legal mess. So, but there, this is all going to play into, I suspect, into the talks of whether or not to privatize in some way, shape, or form PwSA.
Well, the mayor, in a conversation I had with him last month, was talking about it's not going to be privatized. It's going to be a private-public partnership.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
Yeah, okay.
Shades of gray, I guess.
I want to point out one thing about the legal process that they're in. They're not being sued in a court of law. They're in private arbitration because that was part of the contract.
Yeah. Right. Okay, so Liz, I know you did. You went to some public meetings, and this was earlier this year. And how would you, I want you to compare, how was the attitude then, whether it was anger, concern, fear among the public, those attending the meetings, versus has it changed all over the last couple of months?
Well, so in January, I went to a public meeting in Lawrenceville, and it was over three hours long. And to PwSA's credit, they stayed and they answered every single question that people had. They stayed after to talk to people, to talk to individuals about their particular issue. At that meeting, people were angry, they were anxious, they were fearful. And, you know, having followed up and done a lot of interviews with different customers since that time, I mean, that's generally the feeling I'm getting from people, especially people who have little kids. People who are pregnant or planning to get pregnant, people maybe with autoimmune disorders or some other kind of illness. I talked to a man who has leukemia, whose oncologist told him not to drink the water from the tap. I also get the impression broadly that people are feeling distrustful of PwSA in general. So from billing problems to lead levels to the flush and boil order to recent rate increases, people seem to be very frustrated but aren't really certain what to do, which just in turn exacerbates that feeling of anxiety.
2 minutes remaining, and I want to get to both of you. Has there been any improvement, whether it's in the testing process, turning, you know, speeding up the results to people, even getting results to people and speeding up how quickly they get it? Are there any changes planned on the anti-corrosive process? Reid, we'll start with you.
Yeah, so they're right now, the water quality department at PwSA, I visited them, and they are testing out different anti-corrosive agents, including soda ash. It's pretty cool. It's like a science experiment down there. But so they've gone back to, you know, the original anti-corrosive agent. Lead levels are down. They're still over the EPA action limit. So that's sort of headed in the right direction, but not there yet.
And what have you learned, Liz, about any progress being made?
Well, from what I can tell, the lead testing process, now that it's almost completely outsourced, the consumer lead testing, not the compliance lead testing.
Right.
It has improved. I've talked to a handful of people who said that, you know, I got it. I got my kit in a timely manner. I sent it in and I got my results in a timely manner. You know, zooming out a little bit and looking more broadly at PwSA, there's this advisory panel. And, you know, as Reid said, they were talking maybe about some sort of public-private partnership or something like that. But Peduto has said generally that he wants to reinvest in the authority and that it's been neglected for decades. But and you know, PwSA, as of December, they were $750 million in debt. Their operating budget for this year is $130 million. So that kind of gives you a little bit of the bigger picture of what PwSA and the city more broadly is facing right now.
Right now, one out of every $2 goes to paying off debt is what we understand. Liz Reid, health and science reporter for WESA, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
Reid Frazier, reporter for the Allegheny Front, thanks so much to you as well.
Thank you, Kevin.
Coming up, we continue our discussion on lead, hidden poison, with a look at replacing those lead lines. That's next on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're discussing lead, lead in our water, the environmental and health implications as part of our joint project, Hidden Poison, with our media partners, Allegheny Front, Keystone Crossroads, and Public Source. In studio with us now, Julie Grant, a reporter with the Allegheny Front. Welcome, Julie.
Thanks, Kevin. Hi.
And Margaret J. Krause is WESA's Keystone Crossroads reporter. Welcome back, Margaret.
Thanks, Kevin. Hello.
Tweet your questions, comments, use the hashtag WESAConfluence. Before we talk about your reporting this particular week on these issues, Margaret, you before you came into the studio here, you were at the PWSA board meeting today. Any news other than the meeting was canceled?
Yes, there was not a PWSA board meeting this morning. It has been rescheduled for Friday the 31st. The time has not yet been confirmed. The reason given to me in the lobby was that new board members needed to be sworn in.
Yes. Earlier this week, we heard from the mayor's office that three board members whose terms actually expired December 31st, but had still been sitting on the board until they were replaced, were being replaced. But at that time, the mayor's office did not release the three names and replace. Do we know anything new on that yet either?
It was thought that there might be an announcement today, and we probably won't see one until next week.
Okay, very good. Okay, now on to your reporting. There is action, or at least studying of potential action at all levels, federal, EPA, state, DEP, and of course local, Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority. EPA is considering updating what is known as the lead and copper rule. That's what you were reporting on earlier today, Julie. What's this rule? It's a federal rule. And what are the nationwide requirements?
Well, that's a big question. Okay, the lead and copper rule was published in 1991 through the EPA, and it sets out guidelines for water systems throughout the country on how they are supposed to ensure that their corrosion control is taking care of any lead in the water, because that's the way, on a system-wide level, we can ensure that there is low lead and copper, but we're focused on lead here. And it's really meant to protect public health.
So the copper, is that copper lines or is it copper seeping into the water and I guess maybe from those any copper pipes?
Let's talk about lead.
Okay. But I was saying the lead and copper.
The
rule.
Lead and copper,
okay.
That's right.
Okay.
Yes.
The intentions you told us about, but you found some experts that fear changes that are being discussed could actually weaken protections for public health. Why?
Well, let's say that in 2015, in the middle of the year, a working group that was created by the EPA through its Safe Drinking Water Program was looking into updating this rule. It was 25 years old. They thought it was time to look into it. This was before the crisis in Flint really became big public, you know, national news, international news. One of the major things they recommended already at that time was to replace all the lead service lines around the country. So that was the major recommendation.
Including here in Pittsburgh.
Including here in Pittsburgh, that's right. There were a variety of other recommendations, and some of those have been highly criticized. A number of the experts that I spoke with are concerned that, you know, while they say replacing lead lines is important, it's going to take decades, it could take 30, it could take 50 years, and in the meantime, people are being potentially exposed to lead levels that are too high. I mean, any amount of lead in your blood is not safe. And so there are questions about the testing regimes, the tap testing. Of course, I don't know if you talked about it in the previous segment, but the way that taps are tested in people's homes can sometimes be misleading. And sometimes even the water utilities are uncertain of what the proper testing technique should be. And so they're instructing their customers to do it in a way that will not catch the highest lead levels. And some, like in Chicago and other places, are being, in Philadelphia, are being criticized for purposely doing these kinds of things, of getting lower lead levels so that they don't trigger what's called an action level, the 15 parts per billion. And in which case they would have to start taking action, increase their or fix their corrosion controls and start, like Pittsburgh has had to do, start replacing lead service lines, which can be very expensive.
Okay. So here in Pittsburgh, About 25% of water service lines are lead. I spoke with Mayor Peduto last month, and he said one of the big problems is finding out where these lead lines are.
You then put together a capital improvement program that will take at least 10 years. And number three, you create an assistance program, especially for low-income people, to be able to take care of the problems as they enter their home.
Okay, enter their home. Margaret, you did a narrow look, a focused look on a particular neighborhood this week. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Lawrenceville?
Sure. In Upper Lawrenceville, in May of 2016, PWSA began a scheduled water main replacement. And then tests that were done in June showed elevated lead levels in Pittsburgh. And so PWSA took the opportunity to say, the ground is open. We're going to coordinate with homeowners to encourage them to replace their side of the service lateral if we find that it is lead. Out of 340 homes, 58 were discovered to have lead service lines. And so PWSA replaced their side of the line, which is from the water main to the curb. And the homeowner is from the curb to the house. It's important, I think, to emphasize the word encouraged, because Pittsburgh's Water Authority falls under the Municipal Authorities Act,
which means
they are not allowed to spend money on improvements that are not system wide. So to pay for your line and not mine.
Okay. And that is a state law?
That is a state law.
And I know there have been proposals in the last year in the legislature to change that law, but I don't think they've gone anywhere.
I don't believe that they have. Philadelphia, for instance, sought an exception so that they were empowered to do certain things. Mayor Peduto and his administration have talked about taking a similar approach here in Pittsburgh.
Okay, so here we are. You said encouraged, the big word encouraged. How much participation?
Out of the 58 lead lines that were discovered in this one section of Upper Lawrenceville, which is not a big section,
right?
One person replaced their side of the service lateral that was lead.
One person. Then you talked to Councilwoman Deb Gross about the lack of participation.
I think it's a great question to ask whether people understood the health risk and also understood the opportunity in front of them.
Yeah. Julie, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, we were talking a little bit ago about the update or the recommendations to update the federal lead and copper rule. And one of the big recommendations is this public education piece. What they're saying at the federal level is people just don't really understand how serious the problem of lead in water can be. And while it's expensive to fix your lines, you know, it can be $3,000 or more dollars to fix that, to replace that lead line. There needs to be, and this is something that they're pushing for in the recommendations to change the rule, is really mandating that water utilities put out a public education program so that people understand how dangerous this can be.
I want to clarify something, if we could. So how many lead lines did they find in this Lawrenceville area?
58.
Okay. So that was from the main line to the curb, correct?
Yes.
Is there any reason to believe that it wasn't also lead from the curb into the house?
You know, the records don't show. In the same way that Mayor Peduto, you had him saying,
right,
we have to find them. It's unclear.
Okay.
It's probable that they are lead, if it's lead from the water main to the curb.
So Julie was talking about an education program. You were talking about the lack of participation from encouragement. And Julie mentioned the cost, and a cost example. So is this effort in Lawrenceville a failure?
You know, PWSA Interim Director of Engineering and Construction Bob Weimer stands by the success of the project because they have decreased the amount of lead line in the system as a whole. And they also found out how big of a lift it's going to be from PWSA and the private homeowners to replace these lines.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that brings up for me in some of the reporting that I've done, and I'm sure you found this, is that if you replace the main line but you don't replace the service line, it can actually make things worse in people's houses because you have, what's the word I'm looking for? You've interrupted or you've kind of disturbed the lead in those pipes in people's homes. And so you can actually increase, at least temporarily, the lead in people's homes.
And I think, too, right, they can increase for 3 to 6 months, they've seen. There can be much higher lead levels. And in terms of replacement, the... there are places in Pennsylvania, for instance, York is
right,
tearing out private sides of the line, but they are governed differently than Pittsburgh, and I think that's pretty important to point out.
Yeah, and there are places around the country, and I think one thing that this maybe gets to is the expense of this. Is that reasons that people you talked with did not replace their lines, where you only found one? Margaret, I'm not sure if that's...
I actually have not. So I couldn't find anyone that had a lead line and thought about replacing it. There were 11 people that considered replacing it.
Okay. All right.
I guess I was just going to add that in some places, and I think you just mentioned York, but for example, in Lansing, Michigan, they just said, look, we own these lines. They took ownership of those lines and just replaced them all. They took responsibility and just paid and replaced them.
But our state law wouldn't allow that?
So Pittsburgh does not. Lansing does own all of its lines. It's
but
completely
Pittsburgh
city-owned.
Does not own the lines.
As far as I understand it, Pittsburgh does not own all of the lines.
And there are,
PWSA owns the lines? Who?
So that's something I'm still... The Municipal Authorities Act is not particularly clear to me in terms of what it does and doesn't allow, which is something I can readily admit I'm still trying to completely nail down. As far as I understand it, Pittsburgh does not own the side of the line that runs into a homeowner's house, and therefore PWSA can't touch it.
I guess I would also mention that my understanding is that in Madison, Wisconsin, I think Keystone Crossroads has done some reporting on Madison, they're kind of held up nationally because they did a program, because one of the reasons a lot of people don't want to do this, as we've mentioned, is the high cost. And so what they did was said, hey, we're going to put this on your property tax bill. Everybody's going to replace their lines. It's going to, I think it was something like $300 every 6 months on your property taxes. And this is a way we as a community can all just replace these lead service lines.
I was talking with a gentleman this morning. He had worked in other communities, and I have not yet confirmed this with my own research, but there are other communities where when they replace their side of the line and find that yours is lead, their regulation will not allow them to reconnect you to water.
Oh, so they replace it, and now it's up to you to replace it before you actually get your water service restored?
Precisely. And so there's a kind of incentive in that regulation, as harsh as it may seem, to say, you are a homeowner. This is your responsibility. And the URA has passed a vote on the low-interest loan program to help low-income homeowners.
Okay, we're talking about our series, our joint project with our media partners, Keystone Crossroads, Public Source, and Allegheny Front, along with WESA, about hidden poison lead in our water in this particular case. We are talking with Julie Grant, reporter for Allegheny Front, and Margaret J. Krause, WESA's Keystone Crossroads reporter. Another point. So, and this is where lead can keep impacting at one point after another point, is that you can tear out these laterals, these lead service laterals, and it might not just be, it's sort of the tip of the iceberg. What happens even if you have lead and solder, you know, lead solder? Both of you, Julie.
Yeah, that's something that, so the reporting that I did was on the federal lead and copper rule. And as I said, the major recommendation was to replace all the lead service lines. But there are some people I spoke with, for example, Joel Schwartz, who's an environmental epidemiologist at Harvard's School of Public Health. And he says, look, you can replace all these lead service lines, but for a lot of people, that's not going to do the job because they have, as you mentioned, Kevin, you have lead in your solder that connects the pipes, even if you have copper pipes. You have lead in your faucet, lead in various valves. And so to him, what the country should really be focusing on is better corrosion control at the water treatment plants, because you use the chemistry to sort of coat the inside of the pipes so that it kind of holds the lead in there.
So as the water moves through from plant to the main lines, down into the neighborhood, to the lines that go from the street to the curb, from the homeowner's curb inside of the house, all the way to their spigots, it's now the water moving through sort of coats the line. Is that the?
That's the idea. That's why we do. That's why water utilities do corrosion control.
Because the chemistry allows some things to drop out of solution and basically create this mineral. I mean, I think maybe characterizing as mineral is incorrect. So it creates this coating that allows that prevents leaching from pipes. Right. The idea that by replacing just the service lateral, private side, public side, you're going to be fine. If there's a ton of lead piping in your house, it means that your house likely isn't up to code, which means you probably also don't have backflow prevention, which means that any lead that is leaching into your water could flow back into the system. And so even if the laterals are replaced, as Julie said, there's just still this whole other ball game to play.
Okay. Now, Julie, you spoke with Tom Neltner for the story that was on WESA Today and on the Allegheny Front, Chemicals Policy Director of the Environmental Defense Fund, about replacement of lines.
Well, we basically said that the current system makes lead service line the last resort. You only do it after corrosion control has failed and nothing else is working.
Okay. Julie, you also spoke with Yana Lembrinidou. So who is she and what's her position?
Okay, so let's clarify this a little. Tom Neltner, like you said, is with the Environmental Defense Fund. He was on the committee, the working group committee, that worked out with the EPA to make write recommendations to update or to overhaul the lead and copper rule. And like he just said, and as we've talked about, their major thing is opposite of what I just mentioned about Joel Schwartz, is to say, Joel Schwartz says, let's focus on corrosion control. Tom Neltner and the recommendation say, let's, and I will say that the water utility industry agrees with the recommendations of the update of the lead and copper rule, to say, let's replace all the lead lines, because they're saying you can mess up in your corrosion control, but if you don't have lead pipes there, then there's nothing to mess up.
Okay.
I mean, there's different takes on this. So you mentioned Yana Lembrinidou. She works at Virginia Tech. They were integral in exposing what was happening with the lead water crisis in Flint.
Right.
She was also on that committee that made the recommendations, but she wrote a very specific dissent of what they're doing. And one of her major things was, she said the testing at the, and she made quite a connection here, okay? When you're testing at the tap, testing people's homes, it has to be accurate. They're supposed to be, at this point, the way the rule is written, testing at high-risk homes and testing in certain ways. But what a lot of utilities do, as we mentioned before, is like they purposely show lower levels. So that can lead to a mess up in the corrosion control.
Okay. Final minute. We have 1 minute to go. Let's bring this back home, back to Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh has been ordered to replace 7% of lead service lines per year. That's going to take years and years. So what can be done to ensure people, or at least alleviate some of their concerns in the meantime while these are being replaced? We'll start with Margaret. As I said, about 1 minute to go.
Sure. Bob Weimer, the interim director of engineering construction for PWSA, said corrosion control is the quickest way to protect the most number of people. In the interim, as they're replacing lead lines, which could take a decade or more, the city, as well as PWSA and Peoples Natural Gas, are working on a filter program for people's homes.
Okay. Julie?
What can people do? I think testing your water and being aware that you as a consumer have a responsibility. That's the way the law is written. It's not only on the water utility. It's also on you to test your home and know the lead levels in your home.
There are a lot of moving parts, but I agree with Julie. The people that I've spoken with, it's not just PWSA's responsibility.
All right. Julie Grant's a reporter with the Allegheny Front. Margaret J. Krause is WESA's Keystone Crossroads reporter. Hidden Poison Lead is a collaboration of WESA, Allegheny Front, Keystone Crossroads, and Public Source. All of the stories in our Hidden Poison series can be found at hiddenpoison.org. Next week, look for solutions, what can be done. Julie, Margaret, thanks so much.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks, Kevin.
Coming up, President Trump's budget plan calls for the defunding of the National Endowment for the Arts. We'll discuss funding for the arts next on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're going to talk now about arts funding, the proposal by President Donald Trump to defund the National Endowment for the Arts and the arts impact on the Pittsburgh region. And we are pleased to welcome back to our studios Bill O'Driscoll, reporter for Pittsburgh City Paper. Bill, welcome back.
Thanks very much.
Okay. And if you have a comment or a question, you can tweet us. Use the hashtag WESAConfluence. All right, Bill. Every year, arts advocates, artists go to Washington for an arts advocacy day. And this year was particularly big with many more people showing up and participating. As you've been covering the arts in terms of economic impact. Now, what's the message that you have heard when you've talked to artists or arts organizations or sort of a collaboration of arts organizations such as the Greater Pittsburgh Arts Council?
Well, those guys are always trying to promote the idea that arts spending, like most other forms of spending, is economic development. In other words, you know, there's to the extent that there's a prejudice against arts funding, it's that it's just money going to these artists who are kind of doing whatever they want, and you know, it just benefits them. But in fact, when you put up an art exhibit, you have to spend money on, you know, carpenters, you have to spend money on electricians, all these other things. And the money circulates, that ripple effect, you know, that you get the multiplier effect, they call it in economics, right? You get it just with art spending just as you would with anything else.
Right. And we often, I think, maybe some of us fall into the trap of we hear arts and we think of the biggies, the big organizations, whether it's the Pittsburgh Symphony or the Ballet Theater.
The Carnegie.
Yes, of course, Pittsburgh Public Theater, et cetera, et cetera. But there's so many individual artists and smaller arts groups in that do benefit from the investment, if you would, of dollars into their work.
Yeah, and there's one thing that's important to remember, Kevin, is that we're going to be talking about the NEA, the federal funding for the arts. They don't, by and large, in fact, they very little fund individual artists anymore. Okay. They used to do that, and that's kind of what got them into hot water way back in the late 80s and 90s, funding individual artists doing controversial artworks.
Robert Mapplethorpe, for example?
Mapplethorpe, Andre Serrano, yeah. A few other ones, some performance artists who, you know, smeared themselves in chocolate and things like that. You know, the good old days. But lately anymore, the NEA funds primarily organizations and often very specific projects that are not single artist specific. And they do so in, the NEA says, every congressional district in the country. So in small towns, rural areas that would not otherwise have a lot of arts funding.
So this day was scheduled anyway, or these 2 days, Monday and Tuesday in Washington, is that Arts Advocacy Day. They've been doing this for years and years. And one of the largest groups from Pittsburgh, if not the largest group ever. Mitch Swain is CEO of the Greater Pittsburgh Arts Council. We got a hold of him while he was in Washington, and they tried to present the argument that supporting the arts is more than a feel-good thing to do. It's an economic investment.
We return local and state taxes of about $74 million a year. We support, you know, 20,000 full-time equivalent jobs in the Pittsburgh area, $410 million in household income.
They do these studies, Bill, quite often to measure the economic impact on the region, don't they? And that's, I guess, is that sort of their fallback position to defending why we're important, not just for the, you know, the beauty nature of art, but also the economic impact, if that appeals to people?
Sure, arts groups and advocates started making these arguments. You started seeing them more in the last maybe 20 years or so, and probably, you know, the NEA funding and culture wars of the 80s and 90s had something to do with this, for them to make the arts advocates to make this argument to say, you know, we create jobs just like everybody else does. And it's true. There's a lot of people, if you just look around in Pittsburgh, if you count museums, the symphony, all these other things, they do create a lot of jobs. That's for sure.
Okay, you're reporting recently. You pointed out from 14 to 16, the Pittsburgh alone, the NEA had a financial investment in the Pittsburgh area, a big one.
Yeah, this is specifically for Pittsburgh. These are numbers I got directly from the NEA.
Okay.
For the Pittsburgh region, it's probably higher, but from 2014 to 16, the numbers I got from the NEA said $1.4 million distributed to about 30 recipients in Pittsburgh city limits proper, including the Carnegie Museum, City Theater, MCG Jazz, all these other groups that you've probably heard of. And one of the biggest single grant, actually, though, was for the Pittsburgh Office of Public Art for a program supporting artist residencies for groups who work with refugees and immigrants.
Now, that, let me ask you, because other ones are the big, you know, big organizations, Pittsburgh Public Office of Public Art, but that, in a sense, they're then supporting the individual artists, are they not then?
Yeah, so I get indirectly, right?
Indirectly.
So of course, it always comes down to individual people benefiting, right? Whether it's an actor or a painter or something. Right. But the grants themselves do not go directly to individual artists the way they did way back in the 70s and 80s.
How much money are we talking about total if President Trump gets his way to defund NEA?
Well, there's the NEA gets about $148 million a year. There's also, I should mention, the National Endowment for the Arts, which also distributes money throughout the country and in the Pittsburgh area. And, of course, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is also on the chopping block in Trump's budget. But if you just want to talk about the NEA for now, that's $148 million. It's been pointed out that's about 0.004% of the federal budget. It's pretty, pretty small.
Okay. So they're scrambling now to find a way to salvage federal dollars invested in the arts and to keep NEA alive. Are they doing anything else other than the typical lobbying or anything else to call attention to the impact of the arts?
Well, I should say at this point, I interviewed a GPAC staffer yesterday and said that they're not really—
GPAC, of course, is Greater Pittsburgh Arts Council.
Right, the group that Mitch Swain heads, who we just heard from. And they're not really at a panic level or anything right now. There's a couple reasons for that. Perhaps the main one being is that this budget is really just kind of a sketched out proposal. There's going to be plenty of time, you know, over the next coming months to contest it. And they also feel like they do have a lot of support, even bipartisan support in Congress. So what they were doing on Tuesday, the kind of lobbying part of this was going to individual congressmen. In other words, Pennsylvania's congressional delegation, I think there's 18
plus the two senators.
And they saw almost all of them, Republican and Democrat, although they didn't necessarily see the elected official themselves. Mostly it was meeting with staff, but just meeting with staff to say, hey, here's some of the things the arts do in your community. Here's some of our concerns. And generally, it was felt that the folks were receptive to it.
Well, let's hear again from Mitch Swain, a CEO of the Greater Pittsburgh Arts Council. You mentioned bipartisan support. That's what he told us as well, that they've always had the support.
We're confident that the people that have supported us in the past will support us in the future. So we're very hopeful that the recommendations that came out of President Trump's budget will just be some ideology, but not reality.
All right. So you mentioned no panic, but concern, not necessarily pessimistic. How are you? Where are you on that scale of where you assess their attitude at this point?
Well, I think, clearly it's a partisan issue on some level, right? Because if you polled the entire Congress, you'd find more Republicans in favor of proposing or cutting back the NEA than you would Democrats proportionately. On the other hand, there's prominent Republicans, including Mike Huckabee, former Republican presidential candidate, who just wrote an op-ed in The Washington Post defending the NEA. You know, the NEA has been largely non-controversial for probably 20 years now. You know, it didn't really suffer any big blows under President Bush, the second President Bush, by the way. So there is definitely bipartisan support for it.
Okay. Just about a minute to go. As one of the point I wanted to bring up, a concern that they do have, though, is proposed tax code changes, removal of tax deductions, fewer incentives to make donations to arts and cultural organizations. That could be a double whammy, changing those, and if it's not completely defunded, reducing the funding.
It should be said that might be even worse, frankly, because government funding of the arts is only about 7% of total funding for nonprofit arts groups. It's important money because it allows groups to do things they might not be able to do otherwise. The NEA is also kind of gives, when it gives its imprimatur to a group by funding it, it makes other groups more likely to fund that group because the NEA has a really strict screening process. But the charitable giving is really, really big for nonprofit arts groups, from individuals, especially corporations even. If they can't write those contributions off, that's going to really hurt groups, maybe even more than the NEA cut would.
Bill O'Driscoll, reporter for the Pittsburgh City Paper. Bill, thanks so much.
Thank you, Kevin.
And that's going to do it for this week. The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Our engineer is Tom Hurley. The producer of The Confluence, Marcus Charleston. I'm Kevin Gavin. Till next time, hope you have a good week of good news.